Good morning.
Good morning.
It's my pleasure to introduce today's speaker, who lobbies the legislature on education and transportation issues amongst a number of consumer issues. I've met the speaker, I don't know how many years ago, 10 years or more. I can't keep track of years. I don't write down when I did things, so I don't remember. But anyway, it's been a long time. I think he wrote the best article on what's wrong with Hawaii education I ever read that was in the newspaper. At any rate, today's subject is transportation alternatives, and it is a pleasure to present Dave Rolfe, who owns an advertising agency, as well as a consumer advocate.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Lori. What a privilege it is to be here, and what a privilege it is to be on podcast, Larry. My hat's off to you. I have lived in the islands a long time, right around 35 years, and I've had a great respect for the Kukua Council, and I say that with a capital G in great respect. I think because as a citizen, and George did mention that I lobby at the legislature, I have for many years as a citizen lobbyist, and also more recently with some of our clients. But it was such a delight to see people from Kukua Council, and I used to follow all the work that you did, and now it's fun to follow your superb website. So privileged to be here and privileged to start. People ask me, they'll see me and they say, "Oh, Dave, is that a Rolex that you're wearing?" And I'll say, "No, that is a citizen, because that's what I am, and I am proud to be that." That really counts for something in America, and it counted for something years ago in Rome. In fact, St. Paul, it's nice that we're meeting in a church here at Harris. St. Paul, as a citizen, went around the world and carried a great message, in fact, that somewhat helped to change the world. So I respect what the value of a citizen can do, especially armed with words, powerful words, and I want to speak to those today. When George commented that I had spoken so frequently on education, that is true. I define education as the number of words you know and concepts that you can use, and have always said that if we worked on that really hard, we could lead the nation in having our students know the most words and concepts and be able to use them comfortably, allowing them to get into all the top colleges and universities and on and on. So that's really my background. I was appointed to the National Education Goals Panel, Future of the Goals Task Force. There were 9 members of that. There were 5 governors, the Secretary of Education, President of Procter & Gamble, the President of State Farm Insurance, and I was the little president of Rolfe Advertising with only one employee, but I got to sit there in Washington, D.C. and participate in that level for several years, during 1999 and 2000, appointed by the Congress. So in the process, I've been asked to deal with a number of different concepts, and I'm down at the legislature. I work with the automobile dealers a great deal, and they asked me to try to help solve the traffic problem. People always say that we're involved in that as automobile dealers to sell more cars. They didn't ask to have anything to do with that. They said, see if we can help our customers who are fretting out there in these difficult traffic times. And also they thought that traffic gridlock may cause sort of a gridlock of the economy too, and that indeed would hurt car sales. But I wanted to deal with the concept of words because that's the trade that I deal in. I'm an advertising agency owner, and I deal in words. And I wanted to share a quote from Keynes that has always been one that is kind of one that I've always felt sums it. J.M. Keynes says, "I am sure that the power of vested interests is vastly exaggerated compared with the gradual encroachment of ideas. Soon or late, it is ideas, not vested interests, that are dangerous for good or evil." Well, when my children were born, I said to them, even before I whispered anything in their ear, I said, words form ideas, and ideas run the world. And what you have done as effective lobbyists, as citizen lobbyists, is you have brought good words to the legislature, and they have listened to you. And I think I wanted to tell you today how you can be effective in that, in whatever way you're going to decide on these various issues of our day. I don't know if anyone has ever explained to you the rule of 700. This is a words and some concepts I would like to just tell you about. I coined the term, but it's used quite frequently now. But the rule of 700 says that if you take 700 people down to the rotunda at the Capitol, that pretty well much will be the most convincing thing that can be done at any point. And I've seen it done on 2 occasions. In fact, the rule of 700 has never been overturned. Rick Hamada used a great deal of words on the radio when he was concerned initially about the tax increase several years ago, the GET going up 0.5%. And he was able to talk over the air and with other friends, a number of people, into going down to the legislature. I wanted to see if the rule of 700 would come true, so I went to count them. I didn't participate in the event, but I went, took my camera and counted. Right about 705, and I said, that's pretty good. That fills the entire rotunda. And sure enough, it was enough to convince everyone there in the Capitol that the citizens were very serious about this tax being raised without a clear purpose for it. So the rule of 700 prevailed. I saw it occur once again when senior citizens who were involved in adult education projects were about to lose $1.5 million through a legislative act. Well, those senior citizens, I mean, they came with pitchforks and torches and 700 to the rotunda. And it was the most amazing thing I had ever witnessed over a small amount of money, relatively, $1.5 million. But sure enough, within, it seemed like moments, there was a rearranging of that legislation, and that $1.5 million was restored. The rule of 700 had prevailed. Let me explain now the rule of 35. That's why I asked, they asked me how many magazines did I bring. I said 35, with the hope that that's how many we would have. And indeed, with the podcast, we might just about get to that number, because 35 is a very powerful number of people. If you look on the back of the $2 bill, it's a little bit more than that, but those were the ones who gave their lives and their fortunes and their sacred honor signing that document. But it wasn't a great deal of people. That's about 40 or 42, as I recall, that met in 1776. But what can 35 people do? Well, if 35 informed and articulate citizens, as sit at these tables today, to make a telephone call on a single phone within a 90-minute period to any elected official, I assure you that whatever your wishes are will be met with the utmost of respect and likely even in agreement if your argument is sound and you are right. And that's an important thing. Finally, the rule of one. And the rule of one is that one person with, I call it ARR, it's easy to remember, like R, almost like a pirate, R. One person who is ARR, who is agitated, who is right, and who is relentless, can indeed prevail and make change in government. I have been involved in such. Georgia did not mention some of the background on me, but what happened when I was 28 and first came here. This is a citizen story, and this is why I tell it. I noticed that the taxes were in error on the little tax notice that I got. And I don't mind saying that I'd bought the home for $70,000, and it was hard to buy at the time for a young Navy pilot. We bought it, but they had taxed it at $80,000. Well, naively, I called and asked, why is it taxed at higher than the cost that I purchased it for? And they said, well, you should appeal. I said, well, fine, let me come down and get a form. I said, man, look at all my neighbors. They had all bought in those tract homes in Mililani, all around $70,000, but they were all taxed at $80,000, $90,000, and $100,000. I said, why do you tax people at a higher valuation, that if it's a value tax on value, than the value of the houses? They said, well, maybe you should get an appeal for them too. And I said, well, give me 6,000 forms. Well, they went, 6,000. I said, well, that's somebody living in Mililani. So they said, you only have 7 days. You'll never get it all out. And I said, well, if there's an error, and I just stumbled across it, and maybe I should help do that. Anyway, my council member at the time was Taraki Matsumoto. I said, I must have a council member. They said, yes. So I said to the tax director, I said, may I borrow your phone? And I called, introduced myself. I said, could I get you to mail 6,000 forms out? He said, bring all the issue. And he did. Well, they had thousands and thousands of appeals that year. The pickle was they only heard 600 appeals a year. So with I think they had 9,000 appeals. So they had, imagine now, 15 years backed up of appeals. I went to the governor, and he allowed me, as a single individual, even though I wasn't an attorney, to represent all the people in Mililani in the appeal before the appeals board, which I took very seriously, and I studied hard. I was a citizen. I didn't have that much time to do all this. I was an active naval aviator, but I knew that we could help fix this. Well, I went down, went through the flip charts of the 70 homes that I used as an example, and the appeal board listened to me and said, very well, thank you. And then they sent out a notice to the 12, let me see, there were around 6,000 people in Mililani that had appealed, I think. He said, in the matter of the Mililani home appeals, as represented by David Rolfe, they went, denied, period. And I said, well, you there was no objection. No one said anything about my flip charts. No one even made a single question. How could a six-member board deny that? They said, sue us. Well, that was very hard to do for a young man. I mean, raising a family. And I said, if you really want to know, they said, sue us. I said, well, I would think you would be obligated to tell me. And they said, sorry. So I sat down with my wife at the kitchen table and said, honey, I'd like to resign from the Navy. I think I'm going to study law. I think in a year I could have this organized enough that I could sue over our $134. And she said, and what will that cost us? And I said, I think about $25,000 to live for the year. But I think we could do this. And I must do it now because everybody trusted me. They turned in $12 to make this appeal. It was denied. Everybody lost the $12, and nobody knows what happened. And now they just simply say, politely to me, sue us. I tried to find an attorney. He wanted $10,000. Anyway, it's tough to even talk about because we did sue, and we ended up in circuit court in front of the robe judge. And the long story short was there were four attorneys for the state. Sherry and I represented ourselves pro se. The state moved to dismiss, saying that I, as not an attorney, had not filed the papers correctly. And I had a little bit of an agitated conniption fit over the fact that I'd worked for a year and I'd filed an 80-page brief. And the judge, recognizing this agitation, and said, when I had said that you'll deny the people of Mililani $2 million, he said, come back to my chambers. And he said, what have you done? And I said, well, here's my brief. And he said, no one showed this to me. So he read it. Oh, he was angry. So he went back out, told the state they would not dismiss, and they asked to hear the case. We did hear it. He decided in our favor. I won the $134 back. Of course, nobody else got the money back. But so when someone had said, everybody will take a dim view of this if you take it further, I said, well, it's not fair to everyone else. What do you mean take it further? Let me go to the legislature and ask them if they'll pass a law that said this should apply then further, which they did. They eventually moved all the assessors from the state. This connects, by the way, to my speech. It's circular. It's going to finish on this case, by the way. They moved all the assessors from the state over to the city as a result of this little $134 case. The judge said this should never happen to anybody again. And anyway, we won the case and moved forward, and I went on with our lives. I started in the ad agency business. But that was a time where the rule of one just prevailed. In other words, I was on a small board like this, the Mililani Town Association, and I was the vice president, and I said I will take the task of trying to correct the taxes. As soon as I got it corrected, I resigned from the board, said I accomplished my goal, and thank you very much, and other people need to serve. And so we kind of went on, raised our children, and I've lived here, and I've enjoyed a business, and I've enjoyed being with people like you and others involved in public policy for all these years. Well, so that's a little bit of background on me. I looked on your wonderful, wonderful website and read many of the speakers that you've had, and it's a distinguished group, and I'm just a privilege to be at this talking today, and I will keep this short here. It just seems like a long introduction. But in one of the speaker's titles, the name of his speech was Divided We Fail. And I have drafted an ad that was sort of black on one side and white on the other because it's such a black and white issue. And I had titled it Divided We Rail, because we're about to enter into a decision that, and the community is very divided on it. And I thought that we could not do that, or even the overhead lane decision, without a great deal of discussion and the community coming together before we ended up with something that was divided us so dramatically, and particularly had such enormous prohibitive punishing costs attached to it. So I began looking at the words that were used because I was assigned by the auto dealers to try to solve the traffic problem. I thought perhaps that can be done through the rail. And I began first noticing that there was consistent use of the word light rail in all the conversation. But light rail is not what's being proposed in Honolulu. What's being proposed in Honolulu is heavy rail. So I went to count all the numbers of the papers and the TV stations. In fact, we paid for an abstract just to determine how many times the incorrect term light rail was used. Light rail refers to a rail that's generally put at grade, that draws its power from an overhead source, like a streetcar. Portland has such, Salt Lake has such, and many of the ones that people compare to are really talking about light rail. So less carrying capacity, and it's just quite a bit different than heavy rail. Now, heavy rail is a much bigger operation with usually the power in the center, the veritable third rail that you're not supposed to touch. And that is usually done either in overhead, like the L in Chicago, or subway in New York and Boston. But it is a much different operation, usually much more costly. And I'm not saying at this point that I thought it was wrong or right. I was just puzzled by the continuous use of the word light rail, when indeed it was not light at all. It was the heavy rail. But I have never seen any of the advocates of it ever refer to it as such. And that started to bother me, particularly since what were there heavy costs then associated with it, or what else was associated. So I looked at Salt Lake, and I passed out that, because Salt Lake is such a parallel and was used so often, they have about a 20-mile track that goes through a town that is divided in the Great Valley with a lot of vertical development like New York or Hong Kong or many of the other cities, even Boston, but a lot of horizontal development, suburban development, and that's what Salt Lake is like. It's about a 2 million population there. And they had a 20-mile line running to their university, which is very similar to what was proposed here. Well, everybody kept saying, let's do the Salt Lake, and I said, fine. And we saw on the chart I passed out on page 8 on the Hawaii Dealer magazine, we saw that Salt Lake cost was around, in 2006 dollars, just a little under $400 million, $376 to put the whole thing in. Well, you could find that much money in the back of the sofas. I mean, that's not a great deal of money. And if you could put a 20-mile system in for $376, you'd have the auto dealers down there helping out all they could, or you'd have all of business down saying, let's do that. I mean, that's a great solution. Could we get that in for $376 million in Honolulu? The reality is that Honolulu, it will probably cost around, as this chart points out, $4.1 billion, perhaps even as high as now as $6.4 billion for the complete line that goes to the university. So instead of being that 282 cost per person in Salt Lake, it's $4,224 cost per person to put in the rail. It's just not double, or six times, or 10 times. It's 20-fold. Well, when it is that astronomically staggering, then one has to stop and say, now, one moment, this can be difficult on an economy. This might be hard on taxpayers. I'm not sure we could get enough value out of something like that. Because what happens at 3 minute head times, you can figure it out for yourself. A train coming into town from Kapolei, even if it carried 300 people on it, and that would be a near football long stadium, a station to stop at, and there'd have to be about 30 of them, up overhead, built on this giant concrete bridge, what happens is, you get this billions and billions and billions spent for this this train, but it can only come, let's say it came at 3 minute head times. Well, carrying 300 people, a 3 minute head time is 20 times per hour. So it's about 6,000 people per hour. Interestingly enough, the same as overhead lanes would bring in, because there's three overhead lanes, they bring in about 2,000 per lane, about 6,000 cars per hour. So the train would bring in 6,000 people per hour in the 2.5 hours of the rush hour. About 15,000 people could come in on the train. Not hundreds of thousands, or, you know, the types of things that people kind of refer to. So it might be, even at its greatest success, likely that it could get up to 50,000 people in total. 15,000 in the morning, 15,000 out is 30,000, and maybe during the rest of the 24 hours you might get another 20,000, but it's unlikely. So Representative Marilyn Lee goes to Puerto Rico to study their system and comes back and tells us, oh, look at Puerto Rico. Well, we should emulate them. They're a 10-mile system. I read Marilyn, who's from my district, I mean from Mililani. I'm the opposite side now of the district. But I told her, I said that Transurbano story was very interesting. I am interested how they did it elsewhere. And she said, well, the ridership was less than projected. She had mentioned that in the story. Yes, it was less than projected. We've now learned that the officials estimated 80,000 and it came in at 25,000. It was not slightly less or a little bit less. It was dramatically less. It was 30% of the projection. She said, well, it just shows how it can succeed. Well, succeed, they had projected it at $766 million to build that out. The Fed said that they would allow up to $1.25 billion, but the real cost came in at $2.25 billion, you know, 1.8 times the actual cost. So, and that's in an island of 2 million people. So if since we have 40% of that population, how could we achieve these near 100,000 ridership that everyone says is going to happen on our train if we have 40% of the population? And our train could cost six, seven, eight, nine. It just, the billions just keep, the meter just keeps running. It's a very nervous moment. And we as a people have to stop and say, if indeed we're going to proceed down that lane, if we were going to take a deep breath and say that we have to do that, then how then would we ever stop the traffic problem that ensues? Because if you ignore the people that are still going to be growing into the leeward corridor, if you ignore that number, they can't all get on the train, and the train is a point A to point B, so they can't all go where they want to go. So there will still be people, probably 92% of the people, will still use roadways. And if the roadways did not improve their lane capacity, we would have a traffic level of F. Well, the traffic level of F is a rating that transportation officials give. They rank it from A, which is very smooth flow, and B, which is has some restricted flow, CD, all the way down to F, which, and then levels of F, which is motorists stopped, angry motorists, overheated radiators. I mean, it's really, F goes down into minuses, all the way down to minus 10. So what's happening is shockingly, in the city report and in all the reports with regard to the alternatives analysis process, every alternative, the train, the proposed smaller overhead lanes, the highway lanes they had used is kind of an example, the no build and just using buses, all in the year 2030 result in traffic level of F, which defined, by the way, in real numbers, for numbers people here, is a TTI, a travel time index, of 1.81, which is, if anyone lives in the Leeward Corridor, and if you were there on Martin Luther King Day when they did an unannounced painting of the stripe, there was an absolute chock-a-block gridlock, because I live in Mililani, of 2 to 3 hours. 2 for those with the front of it, 3 for those at the back. And we were chock-a-blocked on the highway. That is 1.81. I just said, I can't fathom that we would plan to create 1.81. It is impossible to imagine that any officials would ever plan. That is what the planning is being set down for. So we said, well, if you're planning for that, can we offer some alternative ideas if you must proceed with the train, which it looks like it's a fait accompli. Others will contest that. But if we must go through this, can we not also put in some overhead lanes? The Texas governor recently was faced with the same pickle, and he said, well, you can have no lanes, or you can have slow lanes, or you can have toll lanes. And what he was alluding to was the fact that gas taxes, because cars are getting a little bit more miles per gallon and they're using less gas because the cost is going up, are not producing enough revenues to produce the lane improvements and additional lanes that we need. And so places like Texas and Tampa and others, many across Australia, throughout Europe, have gone to private companies, said put up the money and recover the costs and let the users pay it back in tolls. What I passed out was this wonderful little kind of picture of a hourglass. If you want to go to take a look at that, this hourglass sort of explains. It's perfect in a visual imagery, because if you get onto the roads out there in Leeward, you're going to take about an hour to get into town because you have to go through this narrow neck and the roads get kind of crammed up. If they put in the rail, because it has to stop at 30 places and it can only average 22 miles per hour, maybe 25 max, the rail will take a full hour for you to get in. But if you went overhead on the lanes at 60 miles per hour, and by the way, the Tampa people are griping that 60 was too low. They insisted to go to 65. You could go in 20 minutes. So I don't know if you've moved back to the islands and are living out on the Leeward coast, but the Leeward folks are really faced with a difficult thing. Now, why did auto dealers then want to try to find a solution? It's because the productivity of the marketplace goes down dramatically the longer you're stuck in traffic or having to transit to your workplace. And while, in fact, e-commerce is alleviating a lot of that. They call it, this skips my mind for the moment. E-commuting, right, yeah. Basically using your computer at home. And while that actually is beating up van pooling and everything else, and that development may help save us anyway. I talked to several legislators, and they advocated taking the undergraduate UH population and moving that to the new Kapolei location and making graduate school in Manoa, thereby moving the great body of people to this glorious new elegant university. And I thought that was a brilliant idea, just reverse the traffic in that way. Others have suggested starting the traffic at UH at 9 o'clock. But let me just kind of close for, and then open for questions, because the documents there are very clear, and I'd like to think that this group might maybe have a question or two. But the beauty of the overhead lanes is that they can distribute the traffic down so elegantly. They can allow trucks and other emergency vehicles to, well, they can allow emergency vehicles to use them, and then trucks would move faster on the lower lanes. So again, if you kind of look real quickly to the picture of what they did in Dallas, they were faced with these very difficult crosstown problems. So they put in those two toll expressways. They make a great big T. I was recently in Dallas, and when I rented the car, they just said, well, if you have this additional fee, it'll read your license plate and you're entitled to go up on all the toll roads, which I did, and rapidly transited the town instead of staying down in chock-a-block traffic on the surface streets. What they proposed in Atlanta, which is even a more graphic illustration, you'll see all the red roads going in and out of Atlanta. That's traffic level F. And it looks like, I don't know what I would compare that to, sort of a spindly dandelion or I don't know what, but all the roads are red. When they move to hot lanes, overhead hot lanes and other traffic relieving measures, they move all their traffic around it in the green, which is A and B. You can just imagine how much smoother life would be if you could go and come places at your own choice with this great amount of mobility. Now, what's happening in the CAFE standards debate, even as we speak, the corporate average fuel economy legislation that's in front of the Congress today is, I asked Senator Inouye, because the numbers were 52 and 35. One proposal was to make cars average 52 miles per gallon. The other was to make cars and trucks average 35 miles per gallon. The timing was a little bit different on those numbers, but I pointed out that 52 in that period of time would pretty much require all vehicles to be electric. And then you would have to move the entire country almost into nuclear power plants to create that much energy so that all those vehicles could pull those gigavolts out of those outlets and in their little 5-minute stops and fuel up with 500 miles worth of juice. Or if you stayed at 35, you stay with a combustion engine much bigger than the 24 miles per gallon most cars, all the manufacturers are averaging now, but it would probably go down to a 4-cylinder, and the vehicles would be much taller, and you would engineer vehicles for the human being versus the vehicle. In other words, they would be the person-oriented versus the vehicle-oriented. In other words, the idea would be to move the person in a taller, shorter vehicle instead of a longer, sleek vehicle, X amount of miles. But the real bottom line was electricity versus combustion. Well, I think that decision will be made. I think it'll be positive either way. And I think you're going to have very high mileage vehicles. I think they're going to be smaller and efficient and attractive. And I think you ought to be having the option to use them instead of getting down on just some chock-a-block roads. You can take the train too. Of course, you'll have paid out the wallet for that really heavily. I've said often those rails have to be platinum and the ties gold, because it's a very expensive operation. All the overhead lanes, on the other hand, are a phenomenal option. Well, I'd just like to close just by saying it's a privilege again to talk to everyone here. The ideas that are being discussed, I hope, can be discussed in a fashion where we look for solutions, not just for a problem basically a solution trying to find a problem. We didn't set out to build anything in particular. We set out to solve the traffic problem. The people with the train did not set out to do that. That was really a development issue, and it had to do with transit-oriented development and where that's going to be going. So if you're a traffic person, you're going to be looking probably at expanded lanes. If you solve the traffic, if that's your big issue. If you have another issue about development and going vertical versus horizontal, you'll probably be more of a train person. But whatever you are, either way, you'll be solving a problem for us. And we need a train eventually and need the lanes right away. So I'll close with my thanks again and take any questions if you have any. Yes, ma'am.
There has to be a motive behind any crime. There has to be a spark plug. Has anyone discovered the spark plug train issue?
And I'll repeat that for the podcast people at home. You had said there has to be a motive behind any proposition. And has anyone discovered the motive behind the building of the rail? There's been a lot of speculation on that, and I'll allow you to read that for yourself, because that would be me saying, oh, this was really the motive for doing it. We know that the motive, I can't say what it was not, the motive of building the rail was not to reduce traffic. That was the announced motive, but we know it was not that, because from the physics and the mathematics and the money, it doesn't reduce traffic. And they even, their studies even show it didn't. It comes out with F. So I can eliminate motives. So it wasn't to reduce traffic. You can just start guessing what it is.
Is there
a
person who is pushing this
legislation? The mayor of Honolulu is the primary force behind putting the rail in. But, you know, I don't fault the mayor for that. The mayor believes that that serves the purposes of Honolulu. I think there should be a lot of questions about what purposes. He's starting to explain his transit-oriented development purposes. And as long as those are laid on the table and everybody understands why it's being done and what we'll have when it's done, because this is the Honolulu we have. We have a vertical Honolulu afterwards, all the way out. You have this, more of a horizontal Honolulu with yards and sprinkler systems and things over the next 30 years if you stick with roadways. I didn't answer your question mainly because I found early on in my career that it wasn't fair even to the other person to speculate on their motives. But I've learned to say I know what they didn't do. They did not do this to solve the traffic problem. And now everybody's sort of admitting that. Okay, so it doesn't solve the traffic. In fact, it makes it worse. Is everybody saying that it makes it F? And they go, all right, it is expensive. In fact, it's wildly expensive. It's expensive beyond anything that you've ever seen. But that's not the reason we did it. And now we're starting to learn more about transit-oriented development. And the developers are starting to say, okay, if we lined up here, could we then build that? And could be that that may be an answer. Are there some other questions? Yes, ma'am.
So why did they do it? If you're saying that's not why we did it, why did they?
Well, that you'd have to ask, you know, them. And I think they're starting to explain more. I really can't understand why Marilyn Lee, who is up in Mililani, and the train doesn't even go up there, why she would take a position that would be for the train. And that she's never really explained. For that matter, neither has the neighborhood board in Mililani, which I think is taking a pro-train position. It's a puzzlement to me because it doesn't solve the traffic problem. Everybody says, well, we're doing this to solve the traffic problem. And when you point out the numbers show that it doesn't do that, they go, well, never mind. We're doing it for that anyway. So, well, nobody even says it'll do that. Well, never mind anyway. That's a puzzlement to me. I think if you have to ask yourself, what are the numbers? Would you do the calculations? How many cars can travel and how many cars are taken off the road? Look at the St. Louis numbers. Very few cars are taken off the road. They said they could have bought everyone a full-blown car in St. Louis that left the roadways to take their new train, their light rail train, I might add. So with the money that it cost, they could have bought them a car. Well, if we found the motive, it still would not matter. Even if we found the motive, I think now that people are admitting that it won't reduce traffic, that was our key thing. It took us a long while to get officials to admit that traffic will remain chock-a-block, crowded, and gridlocked. I mean, it's pretty much admitted now. It's nothing good about rail on traffic. So everybody says, okay, well, it wasn't about traffic. We never said it was. We said, well, I think the intonation it was. But anyway, Larry.
Could extending the rail out to the suburbs and encouraging the developers to house this could the train actually increase the number of cars that we have?
By extending the rail to the suburbs, would it increase cars to Honolulu? That's a very good question. I hadn't thought about it, but let me try to answer that if I may. Eventually, and I know the folks that think that I'm an advocate against rail. I'm not. I'm an advocate for reducing traffic. So to admit in a podium that rail is a good thing somewhere down the line. In fact, I've said it in all my studies that at some point around 30 years from now, you're pretty much going to have one in to serve everywhere. And somehow we got to find out how to get there. So I'm with those people who want to try to figure out how to do it. But we're going to grow at 1-2% anyway for the rest of the time all the way out to the year 2050. You'll see that in the charts. And so whether the growth will take place whether there's rail or whether there's vehicle traffic going out there. The reason the growth will take place out there is that's the available land. Unless they force everything into vertical, and that's a whole new concept that I'm just, the American dream certainly is the two-car garage and the sprinklers and the kids and all those things. It gets into a little different kind of dream. I think eventually in 20 years, if I could just wildly speculate, because I've thought about it a lot, I think in 50 years, the year 2050, of this jubilee that goes all the way out, you'll have 7 cities built along the South Coast, and they'll be like the Emerald Cities, and they'll be served by rail going to them, and they will then connect to lots of different places. The early families will go in there and raise before they start raising families. And as the kids get a little bit older, those families will try to buy out in the Great Ebba Plain and in the Great Central Plains into the houses. So you'll raise families in houses and soccer fields. And then as you become older, you'll move back into vertical housing. And they will have made tenements for people who come to work there. It'll almost be from English-speaking countries like the Philippines and from India. And the tenements will be large vertical buildings. In fact, dormitories. We're starting to see dorms being built anyway in some towns. Kona, it's hard to find technicians to work over there, so dorms are being built, auto technicians, for the Goodyear people who work at the Goodyear places. The guy that runs one of the shipping tourist companies here has a dorm built in Lahaina for the crew. So you're going to start seeing more dorms for people who work built. And then connecting with rail, it makes some sense. We're talking out in Never Never Land. I hope we all make it out to Never Never Land. I had lunch with a centenarian last week in Boston. She bought me that lunch. She drove and bought me a lunch. I insisted to buy, you know, but she paid the $14 to buy my lunch. I've never had a 100-year-old buy me lunch. It's 55,000 of them, by the way, out there. Yes. Yes. Multimodal. And your question was, you sense that we have to have more modes besides rail to solve the problem. Uh-huh. Oh, certainly. In fact, we started with that view. We just said instead of building the rail first and then chocking up the chock-a-blocking the traffic, build the first thing to do would be to build the overhead lanes and then build the rail. So we just reversed the order. And we thought that solved the problem. The problem is, if you build the rail and the overhead lanes together, people won't ride the rail because they can comfortably go places on the overhead lanes and they get to leave their garage and make their choices because of the flexibility of their schedules. This happened in Greece. They built, for the Olympics, they built a train and they built a tollway right next to it. Now, the train is called the most expensive limousine in all of Europe because no one takes a train, only 16 people sometimes on an entire 300-person train. But the tollway that runs right next to it is paying for itself just quite readily because people will use their cars to move along. So if you build the train and the tollway together, people just will never use the train. Now, what the advertiser, oh my goodness, what the advertiser has suggested is that we put bus lanes in the middle of our highways, make it so uncomfortable for people to drive cars that they're forced into public transit. They call it nudging people out of cars. This is a really bad idea because people will actually put up with just the pain of being in the car for the flexibility of it, that you really can't force people to change their habit pattern like that. You can entice them, but to have the paper say force, I would disagree. Excuse me.
At one time, several years ago, the question of where are all these people going to get water? And so I imagine that taking the water that was supposed to be watering the sugar and pineapple into houses, and that was political because the people of the valley said, it's our water, we should keep it.
Wiley.
And somehow it was backed off there.
What a wonderful question. In fact, sugar being such a thirsty crop, you know, required all that water. Granted, now there is no sugar there any longer, and granted, there is no pine. So there is an abundance of water in that area for 50 years.
But it's tunneled from my holy.
It's tunneled. I know, it doesn't, I mean, it's not from that area, yeah, that was reserved for that area, thank you, yeah, that came from Wyoli, percolates down to the mountains. But it's somewhat in abundance, but if farmers were to want to have it again, then that's the big political decision. Are you going to build houses or farms? Good question. And George, and then you, sir.
For years, I've been thinking that they're doing away with parking spots to force people to do ride transit. And that's before they even started talking about mass transit. Today's paper, there's an article where they come up with a very creative idea. They're going to do away with 35,000 parking spots to give emergency vehicles more room to get through, except I've never heard of someone dying waiting for an ambulance that couldn't get through, or a house burning down because of fire engine.
Let me sum your question for the listeners on the air. Years ago, you had read and speculated that people would want to do away with parking stalls, so as to force people into the transit mode. In today's paper, there was a story saying doing away with any parking on two sides of the street, basically so that emergency vehicles could go through. That was to have the net effect, though, of reducing 35,000 parking stalls. Now, and then your question then was, do you think it was done for that reason? To force...
I just think that's a more creative reason.
I've heard people in the council bring up things like we should be like one of the islands, whether it's Jamaica or Bermuda, I can't recall, limit the number of vehicles. I've heard some great deal of speculation. So this may be trial balloons and test balloons for discussions, and that's fair enough and fine enough. Even the emergency vehicle people said they don't support that any longer, though. I don't think it'll go that far. Yes, sir.
You've been talking about this overhead system as a toll road. Why does it have to be a toll road? Why can't it be a publicly financed and owned utility like other roads?
That's an outstanding question. It runs about $2 billion, and the roadways are built with highway funds, and the highway funds are not adequate to build such a $2 billion system. Now, the money that they're trying to obtain from the federal government, the $1 billion, is out of the transit funds. So what happened years ago, out of the old highway funds, they set aside 20%, which would only go to transit. But Hawaii never got its hand into that bag of money because we don't have a major transit system that could pull billions out of it. So what happened is we had to have a system put in that qualified for federal transit money. And you can't take that money that's being raised now, that 0.5%, to get it matched with the feds with all their money to use for highways, because that's prohibited.
Even if the highway were to have on it a super bus system?
Thank you, because that's exactly what the highway is supposed to have in the hot lane. The hot lane is designed as a fixed guideway, and this is why I chastise the papers. They keep calling it rail. Rail decision hasn't been made yet. They have decided to set the route for a fixed guideway system, and we are in the back of the room always holding up our hands saying, can that fixed guideway not qualify for transit funds if you put a bus route on it and have a bus lane? And it also, as the buses travel, as we've learned, there's great headway times between these buses. You could then bring cars up and have them pay tolls to run in between the big spaces. And that's what a hot lane is, a high occupancy toll lane. So you have buses flying on it, and then it can get the transit money. So to answer your question, yes, you can use that overhead the fixed guideway, which doesn't require 30 240-foot stations, by the way, and all those elevators and $6 billion. It takes about $2 billion to build that all out with the traffic devices that you put in the surface streets. You do all the north-south over and on the big intersections and all the east-west under, and you put six big over-under passes in the city of Honolulu, six off-ramps of that highway. Long answer to your question. Yes, you can use it for that.
Well, yeah, but I'm still confused, Dave, as why, if that would then qualify for federal transit money, why you are still talking about a toll road.
Well, oh, because
a toll road.
Well, the federal transit money for that would likely be every 6 years at a maximum of about $500 million. So maybe in 12 years you could get $1 billion, but it costs $2 billion. And so to come up with the other billion, you have to ask that a private company fund the whole thing. Or you, there's another possible way you could do it with bonds, barely, just barely, to cover that other billion. And pay it off over 50 years. So it is possible to do that. But, oh, no, come to think of it, they won't give you the money. They won't give you the money unless you have some type of revenue source. So the feds won't even give you the money unless you can show some revenue source. And that tax is the way they got that federal money. Again, that's not a slam dunk or a done deal. I've studied that at length. Probably 500 million increments, and that's why they say the billion, with luck. But not $6 billion or $12
billion. Just for your information,
good to see you though, too.
On the private funding, it can be done by the state pension fund. They could become the owners of the highway. And that way, you wouldn't have any trouble where, you know, some foreign company would take over the highway. It would be your own state funding pension fund.
The question is, and the comment is, could the... the state pension fund, the employer's retirement system, the ERS, fund the missing monies, which I think is a brilliant idea. So much so, by the way, I phoned them and asked them, and one of the board members indicated that there was some kind of pickle with that. The reason I thought it was so perfect is the unions, who basically get to benefit from the ERS, also would benefit doubly. They would benefit from money going in and money coming back out. It would just be the ultimate thing, and they would get the work to put it up. But they objected, saying they could not do that.
One other point, the state of Pennsylvania is thinking of doing that.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, well, now that's worth the whole trip over here. I hope I've been some worth, but I'll look into that. Thank you. George.
Is it true that no rail system has ever been funded with a bond issue, but that all toll roads have? And the reason being that railroads don't pay back and toll roads do?
Correct. All toll roads have generally been done with bond and or tolls and a combination. It's a quasi-government authorities. The sad thing about rail is it operates at such a massive deficit of, I've speculated, between $25 and $30 per rider. So every time one of those 50,000 riders gets on every day, the rest of us have to come up with about $30 per, because they're only going to pay $2 to ride it, but we're going to have to subsidize it with this masso profundo, to use my son's term, amount of money for each rider. Yeah, no private enterprise will have anything to do with any kind of subsidy like that. Who would do it? Yes. That puzzles me that Cliff talks about that. Then your question was, why wouldn't we go with three lanes instead of two lanes? And I'm not sure why Cliff continues to maintain the two-lane position. I think it's because he felt that maybe that's what was proposed, and the only thing now practically that he could go back to, because there wasn't a three-lane proposed, is the two-lane. But the reality is the three-lane, which, by the way, is reversible, so that it's three lanes coming in the morning and three lanes going out in the afternoon, or two and one can be done. But they call it six-on-six because that's the equivalent of six lanes, three out and three in, on a six-foot pedestal, six-on-six. And that's what they did in the picture at Tampa. We studied the Tampa system. Tampa person came out here, Marty Stone, explained all about how they'd done it, quasi-government authority, beautiful. We brought Linda Figg out, who has written the book Bridges as Art, which just, I shouldn't say we, the Hawaii Highway Users Alliance, of which the Trade Association is a member, and bless their heart, that Users Alliance is made up of citizens like you, and oh, they're wonderful people. So they brought Linda Figg out, and I went to see one of the bridges that she'd made in Boston. Oh, it's magnificent. You know, it looks like Bunker Hill Monument, and it has all the wonderful stanchions and strands. So we could have an overhead piece that would be artistic and beautiful. Indeed, H3 lies lightly against the mountain. I think that basically we're talking about building H3 over H1. When people say, what is this going to be? Oh, it's going to be so formidable. I go, well, you know, we all watched H3 go up, and it's a beautiful highway to navigate. We're effectively talking about putting H3 over H1, and it costs about $2 billion, including all the distribution things and the over and unders and the stoplights being coordinated, by the way. That all comes in under the $2 billion. Pearl, you had a question?
Yes, I wanted to go back and quote. I believe they're necessary in order to limit the traffic, so that traffic can continue to go at 60 miles an hour. Because if it were free, then we would have just the same condition as in H1.
Thank you, Pearl. Pearl makes a wonderful point that these are managed lanes so that as everybody starts riding them, they raise the toll, and then it eventually keeps it managed so that the traffic can flow at 60 miles per hour. Now, we've frequently heard the mayor talk about the $7.85 maximum top. He calls it the $8 toll. I did see that I-95, the one that this was patterned after, had an $8 toll on Friday night, $7.95 toll on Friday night at its most busy time. And that's basically to keep the traffic flowing. But in general, the toll would probably average around $4 and go as low as 25 cents. But I question and I ask myself if I could move that smoothly in 20 minutes versus an hour at what I charge per hour in my work, would it be worth it for me to get into work in 20 minutes or sit in traffic in an hour? And if I took the train, it's going to be an hour too. So I'm stuck with an hour either way except for the tollway. I'd be happy to pay the $4. It would save me that much gas. And maybe I might even consider that then people would carpool a little bit more and find other people who want to go. But thank you. You've been a wonderful group. I didn't mean to go too long, Larry. The questions were wonderful. And I'll be glad to answer any more at the end. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for a great talk, and we had great questions. We'll have information for you in the newsletter on our meeting next month. So please make sure you get the newsletter. It helps if you're a member, then you automatically get the newsletter. Thanks for coming today. Thanks for George for arranging for our speaker.